So we're going to start with text 106. I said before, I put what you have in the handout. Let me just explain what you have in the handout. As you have four sutras from the Vedanta. Since I don't have diacritics on my computer, and I didn't have the Xerox, but just printed out. They're on the board so that you can put in the diacritical remarks. So these are four sutras from the Vedanta Sutra with the numbers. I'll explain those numbers. And then here's a verse from the Chandogya Upanishad that becomes very relevant. It's also on there. So you can put in the diacritical marks. That's what it's there for. Just so you can do that. Okay. So we're going to start with text 106. Where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu begins his exposition of Vedanta philosophy. So he begins by explaining, he says, the Vedanta Sutra, he starts with Vedanta Sutra, Ishvara Vachana, they're the words of God. Vyasa Rupe, in the form of Vyasadev. So that's his Vedanta philosophy, or Vedanta Sutra, consists of words spoken by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan, in the form of Vyasadev. So right away, you see, we find the grounds that we're dealing on. These are the words of God, quite different from Eliot Deutsch. This is the ground. So in this purport, there's some discussion about what is the meaning of Vedanta and Vedanta Sutra. And this is all stuff that we should know. So I want to go over this to make sure we understand it. So first of all, what is meant by the term Vedanta? Who knows? Wes Prem?
Veda knowledge
unto the end. The end of knowledge, which means? Yeah, the Siddhanta, or as Prabhupada said, Krishna. Krishna is... It's taken different ways. A lot of scholars take Veda and Anta, the end, that is the end of the Veda. Since Vedanta deals with the subject matter of the Upanishads, and the Upanishads are the concluding philosophical portion of the Vedas. We know that the Vedas contain, usually divided into four sections. The Samhita, or the hymns, the Brahmanas, which are instructions for performing sacrifice, the Aranyakas, which are treatises for forest dwellers, and finally the Upanishads, which deal with the highest knowledge. So Vedanta philosophy, the school of Vedanta, it's one of the six darshans, or schools of philosophy, they specifically deal with the knowledge that's contained in the Upanishads. Whereas, at least the Samhita, all about ritualistic activities. But Vedanta begins with the giving up of ritualistic activities. And this is explained here about the Veda, and Anta means end. My first teacher of Hinduism in college was at Temple University Religion Department graduate school, was Swami Nikalananda, who was the head of the Ramakrishna Mission in New York. He was a disciple of Vivekananda, who was a disciple of Ramakrishna. Swami Nikalananda shows up in Prabhupada Lilamrita as the uptown Swami. You may be familiar with him. He used to come down to Temple to teach this class, so I was in his class. So I was told when I began this course that last year, a Bhakti Yogi had come and addressed the class. That happened to be Srila Prabhupada, although at the time I didn't know. And I heard later that Srila Prabhupada had asked Swami Nikalananda's class, what is Vedanta? And nobody knew. So Prabhupada said, Veda means knowledge, Anta means end, and the end of knowledge is Krishna. Vedaischa sarva aham eva vejo. All the Vedas are just searching after me. Krishna says in 15:15. So the Vedanta Darshan, this school of philosophy, is especially concerned with the concluding the ultimate knowledge revealed in the Vedas, especially in the Upanishads. So the philosophy of Vedanta is organized or codified in sutras. That's a word you should know, sutra. And a sutra has been defined for you in the purport to text 106. Is a code that expresses the essence of all knowledge in a minimum of words. It must be universally applicable and faultless in its linguistic presentation. Now you'll find that all the schools, yoga sutras, grammatical knowledge, panini, everything is done in these sutras. And the point of sutras is to compress. And the reason for this is that people didn't have computers with huge memories. They had to remember everything. And wanted to commit a whole complex system of thought and all its ramifications to memory. So in order to do that, they were codified into the form of sutras. Very, very, very compressed. Get rid of as many syllables as possible. So by the time you get the sutras, you can't understand them unless you're already a member of the school and you know all the purports. But then you have all the sutras memorized in your head. You've got the whole philosophy. And the Vedanta Sutra ranges across all of the Upanishads. And many, many verses, a lot of complex, difficult things, and it's all compressed together. So here's the example of a sutra, the first one, you can see on your page here, Atato Brahma Jignasa. Now see, that's very compressed. Atta, now, Attaha, therefore, Brahma Jignasa, inquiry into Brahman. So this, you have to expand a little bit. Now, therefore, one should make an inquiry into Brahman. Next sutra, Janmadasa Yataha. What is its relationship to its previous sutra? Well, in this case, it's clear. It's defining Brahman. Although it doesn't say that, right? That's just understood. Because what it literally says is, birth, etc., of this, from whom? That's what it says. Janma, adi, birth, etc. Of this, from whom? So, from whom means from Brahman. Brahman is that from whom the birth, etc. Janma, adi means birth, maintenance, and destruction of this universe. Brahman is that from which the birth, maintenance, and destruction of this universe proceeds. But see, they've done it in, you know, just a few syllables. Janma, dasyataha. There's the definition of Brahman. So first off, it starts to say, now we're going to inquire into Brahman. Now you can't understand all this unless there's a commentary. So therefore, all the Vedanta schools give their philosophy as a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. How to make the most sense or understanding of these sutras. As you can see, they're difficult, hard to understand. Some of the sutras, some people will take one of the sutras as stating a view to be defeated. Others will take a sutra as stating the view to be upheld. It doesn't say in the sutras. So it's a very complex matter. And it's not designed to be intelligible to outsiders. You're supposed to, because any of this stuff, you know, you don't. It's a big change to start to write about the Vedic literature so outsiders can understand. Usually, the effort used to be so that nobody can understand except those who were qualified and insiders. But in the Kali Yuga, we've made an adjustment here. So this is the, we're going to turn back to these two sutras later on. We'll have some discussion about them. They'll be very important because I think that just by looking at these two sutras, we can understand Lord Chaitanya's criticism of Shankaracharya. So actually we won't need to have to do a whole study of Vedanta to understand. We can just do it with the first two sutras. Anyway, so that's what a sutra is. Now, Prabhupada gives in the purport, he gives the structure of the Vedanta Sutras. It's divided into four books, adhyayas. He calls them chapters here. Four chapters or four books, adhyayas. You can copy this word down, adhyaya. And each adhyaya has four other divisions called padas. So when you see a number, this means second adhyaya, first pada, 14th sutra. First adhyaya, first pada, second sutra. That's what these numbers refer to. He said it's also called Shodashipad. In other words, Shodashipad, 16 divisions. Right? There's 16 padas, four adhyayas and four padas each, 16. So that's how the reference number is like this. There are different names, by the way, for the Vedanta Sutra. We should be familiar with some of these names. One of them, commonly used, Brahma Sutra. Vedanta Sutra, also called Brahma Sutra. And another very common name that you'll run across is Uttara Mimamsa. There's two schools, they're called Mimamsa. Mimamsa means exegesis. There's Purva Mimamsa and Uttara. Purva means early, Uttara means late. Anybody know what the Purva Mimamsa is? It's also one of the six darshans, yeah?
It's a Jaimini explanation
of Karmakanda. Yeah, it's Jaimini's explanation of Karmakanda. It illustrates the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, people who take them as all in all. So Purva Mimamsa. So Vedanta is called, which deals with the higher knowledge, is called Uttara. Uttara Mimamsa. So it's also called Uttara Mimamsa, Purva Mimamsa, and Uttara Mimamsa. So those are different names. There's others, Vedanta Darshan. Okay, so this is the basic structure here of the Vedanta Sutra. So I said the purpose of doing it this way was to organize and codify everything. It was done by Vyasadeva. So the assumption is that Vyasadeva had something in mind. Here in the purport, that there are people who are composing Vedanta codes before Vyasadeva, according to the purport here. But the final compilation by Srila Vyasadeva is considered to be definitive. It's Ishvara Vachana. It's the words of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And therefore he had something to say. He had a point of view. So the commentators, when they do their commentaries, they have to make the most sense of these sutras. They have to show, their commentary should show that how everything is linked together, how everything is coherent, how it all fits together nicely, how everything is explained in a natural, unforced way, and so on. So the assumption is there's actually some point of view that's being expressed. And you see, you get the Shankaracharya tries to explain Vedanta Sutra in his commentary. What's the word for commentary? Who remembers? Bhashya. Yeah, so his commentary is called? Sariraka Bhashya. Anybody know what the phrase, have you heard this phrase? How does it go? Bhashyam Brahma Sutranam. Bhashyanam Brahma Sutranam. Yeah? Srimad Bhagavatam is called Bhashyam Brahma Sutranam. It's also considered the natural commentary. That's our idea. See, here this Janmadasa Yataha. So because Srimad Bhagavatam opens with the same Janmajashaya Tonvayaditaratasti Sabigan Swara, so on. Opens with the same words. It's considered to be Vyasadeva. This was his indication that it was his author's own commentary on Vedanta Sutra. So it's also considered a commentary. That's why Gaudiya Vaishnavas never had a commentary until the time of 18th century of Baladeva Vijayabhushana, where our community could not be recognized unless we presented a commentary. What's his commentary called? Yeah, Govinda Bhasha. I have a translation of it right here. This is Baladeva Vijayabhushana's commentary. Govinda Bhasha. Yeah. Okay, so now let me see. Where are we? Okay, now, another thing that we have to understand is on page 89, in the same purport to 106, Vedanta Sutra considers that there are three different, in the school of Vedanta, there are three different sources of knowledge. Notice this phrase here, prasthana traya, the three foundations of knowledge. So these are, first of all, they're called Shruti Prasthan, Smitri Prasthan, and Nyaya Prasthan. So I hope we all know what Shruti is. What is Shruti? No, but Shruti is a certain category of Vedic literature, Krishnaksha. You know what it is? You know, Graham? Yeah, mantras and hymns, but which mantras and hymns, huh? Yeah, Shruti means the original Vedas, that is, the Vedas up to and including the Upanishads. That's Shruti. That's considered Shruti. Then Smitri. Supplements, right. Smitri is the supplements. And especially for Shankaracharya, the Mayavadi is the only one they really recognize is Bhagavad Gita. And they do a job on that. But anyway. But these are the three. Shruti Prasthan, Smriti Prasthan, and Nyaya. N-Y-A-N-A, long A, Nyaya. Which here refers to the codes of Vedanta Sutra. There's a school also, one of the six darshans is called Nyaya. Logic. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was the professor of Nyaya. One of the founders of the Navanyaya, the new logic. That is, here Nyaya Prasthan means the actual codes. So these are the three foundations of Vedanta. This is the three sources of knowledge, all based on the authority of revealed texts. Right? Any questions about this?
You said Bhagavad Gita is accepted
by Mayavadi. It's the only one that they tend to quote. You won't find too much else in like a Shankaracharya's commentary, the other Mayavadis. You won't find too much from, you know, the Vishnu Purana or the Srimad Bhagavatam. Anything that's too theistic. So the only, their tendency is just to deal with Bhagavad Gita. That's all.
But all the Mayavadis, they all accept all the different, even in the West. Like,
they accept what?
Yeah,
it has that status, Gita Upanishad. It's Smitri, but it almost has the same stature in many people's eyes as Shruti. It's called Gita Upanishad, even though it's not one of the Upanishads. Its authority is so high. Vasupre? Yeah, that's given here. He says this, that there are five different subject matters. Patijna, Hetu, Udharana, Upanaya, and Nigama.
Would you mind to explain that? Because I don't see it.
Because this is the chapter divisions. How can I explain this? They aren't numbered according to these chapter divisions. It's just where you divide up the subjects within this text. So you'll start here and you'll say, you know, certain point among in this pada, you'll say, here's one chapter and here's the next and here's the next and here adhikarana. Here's one adhikarana, here's another, and the subject matter changes.
Five sutras.
Not as far as it changes. Different commentators divide up the adhikaranas different ways, according as to... There's one group within the second pada, the second ajayana that deals with the Buddhists. Everybody understands that they deal with the Buddhists. But somebody may come on and say, well, it's not really the Buddhists, somebody else, you know. Anything else? Yeah?
So with the Vashis, the commentary and Vedanta Sutra or Gita?
Vedanta Sutra. Vedanta Sutra. Baladeva Vidyabhushana. Baladeva Vidyabhushana, yeah.
Once again, the Shruti is intended for scriptures where the Supreme Lord speaks himself. While Smriti, there are scriptures where other devotees describe the activities of the Supreme Lord.
Well, I've heard people say that. I didn't hear it from Prabhupada. Because, I mean, after all, Bhagavad Gita is Smriti and Krishna speaking himself. Srimad Bhagavatam is full of Krishna speaking himself. So I don't know that it's in the Upanishads, there's a lot of people just discussing the absolute truth. The Lord doesn't show up himself at all. So I don't think that's the case.
Prabhupada says that Shruti is a Vedic injunction. The Smriti is a supplementary presentation.
They're considered supplements to the Vedas. But that the one is the Lord himself and the other people is about the Lord, that doesn't seem to follow. Okay, can we go on now? That's clear? Yes?
Just a quick question. Was it the Ujjvalamamsa or the Purvamamsa that was the explanation of karma?
Purva. Purva. Purva means earlier.
Purva means later.
Prior. Purva?
Well,
Uttara is Vedanta Sutra. Earlier. Prior. Jaimini. Okay?
You said that the Brahmanas, were they instructions about sacrifices?
Yeah, the instructions on performing sacrifices and things like that. Let's go on, huh? No more further questions? Now we want to take a little look at Lord Chaitanya's principles of how to understand scripture, or his hermeneutical principles, exegetical principles here. You see these given in 106 and so on. So first of all, he says that they are Ishvara Vachana, that the words of God himself, and that they're free of defects, the four defects of a conditioned soul. So we have to accept them as perfect. Now he says, in text 8, we have to understand these by mukya vritti. You have to understand them as they are. Mukya vritti, the direct understanding. Prabhupada gives an example. He said in that purport, sometimes commentators say that the word Kurukshetra in the first verse of Bhagavad Gita refers to one's body. But we do not accept it. That's called Gauna Vritti or Lakshana Vritti. Indirect, allegorical, symbolic, some other meaning. But he says, no, Kurukshetra, you can go, you can visit it, it's there. This is like, for example, Gandhi, because he tried to find a philosophy of nonviolence in a book whose whole purpose is to urge somebody to fight. So he had a difficult time. So what does he do with this? Well, he says he allegorizes the whole thing. That Kurukshetra means the body, the five Pandavas mean the senses, and so on. And so the war is the war within your heart of good against evil. It didn't really happen. And that's why it's really not telling, Krishna's not telling Arjuna to fight an actual war. Because Gandhi's philosophy was not Vedic. It came from, actually, Tolstoy. That's where he got it from. He did. So this is Tolstoy ended his days as a sage, and so he came up with his nonviolent principles like that. So if you want to find, here's a text that says fight, 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 and you want to say, you know, no fighting, then you have to do something. So this is what he does. So therefore, there's a gona vritti. There's this indirect meaning or this indirect interpretation. So here we see he's in the purport to text number 110. There's a paragraph. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur comments that mukya vritti, the direct meaning, is abhidha vritti, or the meaning which one can understand immediately from the statements of dictionaries. Whereas gonavritti, the indirect meaning, is a meaning that one imagines without consulting a dictionary. So there are dictionaries, they explain meanings. I remember once when Prabhupada was in Philadelphia, there was a scholar that came to visit him that was giving him a hard time, an Indian man, in fact a lapsed Vaishnava. So Prabhupada was saying to him about, talking about Srinada Krishna. He says, Mame kam sharanam braja. So this man said to Prabhupada, what is the meaning of surrender? What is the meaning of surrender? And Prabhupada said, give me a dictionary. And the man got very angry. He said, I want the Sanskrit etymological meaning of sharanam braja. And Prabhupada said, we cannot waste our time like this. You want a Sanskrit teacher, not a spiritual master. He said. But that was Prabhupada's meaning. What does it mean? Give me the dictionary. And again, Prabhupada gave a talk about the meaning of God. He just opened the dictionary, the Supreme Being, and then he kept going. You know. So this is some examples of this this mukya vritti, the meaning that's right there, right? And you don't have to strain. So Lord Chaitanya is saying here that the principle is that, he says, Shankaracharya has explained the Vedic literatures in terms of gona vritti, the indirect meaning. He has covered the direct meaning. So that's his charge against Shankaracharya. Now he says here that Shankaracharya is not at fault for this. He was ordered to do so. We'll return to this later. Mayavadam masach chastram prachanam bodham uchate. The Mayavadi's scriptures are asat chastra. They are impious scriptures. It is prachanam bodham. Closet Buddhism, covered Buddhism, hidden Buddhism, crypto Buddhism. We'll go back to that part later. But for now, here, we should understand this. The impersonalists, in order to establish their philosophy, accept these discussions, that is, the Upanishads and Vedanta Sutra, in terms of lakshana vritti, or indirect meaning. And here we have a little history. And by the way, the different four sampradayas and the names of their philosophies are given here. That's something we should also know as a matter of course. What are the four acharyas, the name of the four sampradayas and the four philosophies that they represent? We should know this stuff. Very, very.
Where is that?
That's right there on page 95. He says, Vishnu Swami, Shuddha Dvaita Vada. What's the name of Vishnu Swami's sampradaya? Not Nimbarka. The Rudra Sampradaya from Shiva. Shuddha Dvaita. And the Mayavadis present their Advaita Vada or Kevala Dvaita, exclusive monism. Ramanuja Vishishta Dvaita, Sri Sampradaya. There it is, Vishishta Advaita. It's usually translated as qualified non-dualism. Vishishta is a little more complicated meaning than that. Madhvacharya say Tattvavada, but also called just Dvaita. And the last one, is he mentioned here, Nimbarka?
What's Madhvacharya's?
Madhvacharya? Dvaita. Dvaita
and Brahma.
Yeah, the Brahma Sampradaya. And then Nimbarka is not mentioned here, is he? No, Nimbarka is Dvaita. called Swabhavika Dvaita Dvaita, as distinguished from Beda Beda. Beda Beda. Beda Beda. As distinguished from Achincha Beda Beda, it's called Swabhavika Beda Beda. And that's the Kumara Sampradaya. Is that right? Kumara Sampradaya?
Yeah.
We didn't get, yeah, that's right. Okay. Kumara Sampradaya. Nimbarka. Those are the, we should know these people. All right. Now, so Lord Chaitanya now establishes the principles that the scriptures are the words of God, that they are free from faults, and we have to understand them as they are through the direct meaning without making strained, fanciful interpretations of words. This is a general principle we should follow. Prabhupada has a... Sometimes, however, he says this, as a matter of necessity, Vedic literature is described in terms of lakshana vritti or gona vritti, that is indirect meaning, but one should not accept such explanations as permanent truths. I just leave that there for you to... So once in a while you'll see it, but it's not to be accepted as the best way to go. Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He doesn't explain them in an allegorical way. They just say they have this meaning. They have this meaning that when you read them, they purify you in different ways. But as far as I understand, he's not saying that they didn't happen.
But he gives a specific meaning.
To each of them. Yeah.
Sometimes we hear in person.
Yeah, but then they want to deny they actually happened. Bhaktivinoda Thakur didn't do that. Yeah.
Is that Lakshmana listed as when there's different ways of knowledge acquisition, like I think Pratyaksha, direct sensory perception.
Lakshana?
Lakshana, isn't that like mental speculation? Isn't that in that list?
No, Anumana, inference, Pratyaksha, direct perception.
Lakshana
is not there. Shabda, scripture. So now let's go on here. We're not going to get as far as I'd hoped today. Now, he goes on here to now beginning to make his points. According to direct understanding, the Absolute Truth is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, by the mukhya arte, by the direct meaning, this word Brahman means Bhagavan. Chit Aishwarya, the spiritual paripurna, full of spiritual Aishwarya, Anurdva, unsurpassed by anybody, Samana, not equaled by anyone. This is what he's saying. If you take the direct meaning, this is all denied by Shankaracharya, he says. But his meaning advocates this theory of impersonalism. They say, they advocate the theory of, in the text 112, nirākāra, without form. They deny spiritual power, spiritual body, spiritual form. All those things are covered. And instead they advocate nirākāra, formlessness. So there's two ways. You can take as your starting point. Let's assume, you see, that the Supreme Person, the Brahman means a person who has name, form, qualities, pastimes, and energies, and makes sense of the sutras of Vedanta that way. And let's assume, start with another hypothesis, that he's formless, has no relationships, qualities, pastimes, and try to make sense out of the sutras that way. When you finish, which is the most coherent, satisfactory, free from contradiction, explains as many things as possible without leaving things out, which is better? That's So you can start with two different ways of going. So his thing is that the direct way, because you have to remember that ultimately how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is going to convince these people at Banaras is the meaning of the sutras is going to become self-evident. It won't be like some long proof. It just, you know, it all like fits together so neatly and so nicely and so coherently. There's no contradictions and everything is explained. It just all falls into place. It's just, there it is. It's self-evident. That's his explanation. And once they see it, just by accepting this hypothesis in the beginning, that the Supreme Absolute Truth is a person, a spiritual name, form, qualities, and he has spiritual potencies. So these are two aspects that we deal with. First of all, that the Absolute Truth in himself, either he has varieties. The traditional ones are described as name, form, qualities, and activities or pastimes. And I always like to add another one, relationships. Names, form, qualities, pastimes, and relationships. Five things. And the Mayavada philosophy say, no name, no form, no qualities, no activities, no relationships. And then we come to how does this absolute truth relate to the creation that we see? According to Mayavadi philosophy, really, it doesn't. It doesn't. No relationships. One without a second. That's what it comes down to, and we'll explain later. Because in the Mayavada philosophy, this creation, it sort of doesn't exist. Sadasat anirvachaniya is their doctrine. It cannot be described either as this existing or as not existing. That's the little crucial doctrine that holds the whole thing together. If you can buy that, then the whole thing, you know, you can try to make sense of it. Sada anirvachaniya. Sada anirvachaniya. This is a technical term. Indescribable. Maya. Is indescribable. Indescribable means as neither existing nor as not existing. Because if you describe it as existing, then it limits Brahman. It stands over against Brahman, which is one without a second. But if it's described as not existing, then what's all this talk about, you know, becoming saved and becoming enlightened and having to get a teacher and all these other things. So they want to have it both ways. That when it's convenient to say it exists, it exists. And when it's convenient to say it doesn't exist, it doesn't exist. That's what they do. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of ourselves here. So they deny the potencies of God, his name, form, everything. And they say that they're a product of the material energy. And on page 100 in this book, which is the purported text 113, we get a little argument that's worth looking at. Due to unclean intelligence, avishuddha buddhaya, or a poor fund of knowledge, the Mayavadi philosophers cannot understand the distinction between material and spiritual varieties. Therefore, they cannot even think of spiritual varieties because they take it for granted that all variety is material. This is due to unclean intelligence. The argument here is their position is essentially materialistic. Because they say, name means material name. Form means material form. Now this is something you can do if you want to construct a philosophical system. You set up your definitions in the beginning. And so if your definition is name means material name, form means material form, then that means if I have an expression like spiritual name or spiritual form, you'll say, you can't say that, that's self-contradictory. Because I've already set up my definitions, that name means material name. But then let's look up at that definition. Who says? Where is it handed down? How do you know? On what authority? Name means material name, form means material form. Well, what can they say? All our experience of name is material. All our experience of form is material. And then Prabhupada would say, well, that's your experience. I'm not a rascal like you. You see, so this is avishuddha buddhaya. This is impure intelligence. In other words, they start with this assumption that they share in common with the karmis. The karmis see, here's name and form in the material world. We want to enjoy it. And the Mayavadis say, yes, material world, name and form belongs to the material world. It has to be rejected. But they share this assumption that name means material name, form means material form, activities means material activities, by definition. By definition. And when you talk about, in Bhagavad Gita, when you talk about activities that are spiritual, you start to sound like you're talking self-contradictorily, right? Because what's in Sanskrit, if you want to say activities that are spiritual or produce no reaction, you have to say karma akarma. Karma means activities, and they produce no karma is, you know, akarma, a nice karma. Yeah? Sure, sure. This is why, you see, because this idea that name means material name means that their senses and their minds are embedded within the material world. This is avishuddha buddhaya. This is, it's the intelligence, you see, that keeps the mind directed in this way. So that if you say something like spiritual form, they say that's self-contradictory. I can't make sense of that. They imagine, you see, we're going to imagine what is spirit. Well, a spirit is the opposite of matter. So matter has form, spirit must be formless. Matter has names that go with these different forms, must be nameless. Matter has activities. And Prabhupada gives some examples like this, you know. That if a man is sick, all his activities are painful. And that's his experience of activities. He's embedded in that life of pain. And you say to him, well, the doctor says, when you get well, you'll do so many things. You'll run, you'll play tennis, you'll do... Oh, no, I don't want to. I can't imagine. I don't want to do anything. So they reject. Well, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur tells this story. Very interesting, very funny story. About a boatman. This example's of the example of how your intelligence can transfer over. About a boatman who used to pull a barge along a towpath. You know, he would walk on the towpath. It was just a human mule with a rope over his shoulder and pull this freight barge along the towpath. And one of the worst aspects of his job was what this job did to his feet, because the towpath was full of thorns and rocks and, you know, it was just horrible. So as he used to trudge along pulling this barge, he would imagine the condition of being infinitely wealthy. He would daydream when he had so much money. And his dream was that when he had so much money, he would line the bank of the canal with mattresses so that when he pulled the barge, his feet wouldn't hurt. You see? So he couldn't imagine, you know, that in this condition of wealth, he wouldn't have to pull the barge. He projected his condition of poverty over into the condition of wealth. So that's why, you know, their minds are embedded. So when they say activity, they can only imagine material activity. They can only imagine material form. And so then they reject them if they apply them to transcendence. No name, no form, no activity. This is how the logic works. So this is one argument that I find, you know. Who says name has to be material? Where is it written? Where is it stated? Who handed down the dictation that all name is material name? So you attack the premise. A lot of times when you're dealing with philosophy, the most powerful... the most persuasive points of the other side are the ones that are not stated. They assume them. They just assume them. They assume that nobody can doubt this. And they never argue for them. They're just assumed. And when you argue, or when you confront them, the tendency is you'll accept the same assumptions unconsciously. And you have to back up and you have to see, well, what are the assumptions of this argument? So the Mayavadi assumption is this, that all name is material name. So you just question that assumption, and immediately the whole argument falls apart. And then you can say, well, what about spiritual name? Well, then it goes on from there, but anyway, that's the... This is this Avishuddha Buddhaya. They deny name and form of God because they think that all name is material. We say, yeah, we deny material name and form too. That's why we accept those statements of the scriptures that say no name, no form. Because in those places, name and form mean material name. They mean material form. Yeah, we agree. But that doesn't deny spiritual name, form, activities, relationships, so on. Last prayer.
So, is this verse qualifying necessarily the mentality of those who say that? You think there is no spiritual form and name, therefore you're going to fall down. Or if a person is tall, there is, can he accept, or is their stage so...
Well, if the purpose is sincere and they just don't know better, and they're actually seeking for the absolute, then Krishna will send them a devotee to explain these things, so that after many births, they actually surrender to Krishna. But there are others that they hear these explanations, they, because of their hostility to God, the idea of God being a person makes them sick to their stomachs. There are people like that. Then that's definitely somebody who's going to fall down.
It depends. That's applying for us to a certain extent until we're completely convinced of the omnipresence and omnipotence of Krishna. We don't really take him fully as a person either. So our intelligence is impure, although we have the rational.
Well, Prabhupada says if you just accept these statements on faith, that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you can be liberated. Just on faith. Our difficulty usually is accepting the notion of God, what that actually entails. Because it entails my full surrender as a servant. And if I say Krishna is God, but I don't surrender Him to 100%, then actually I don't understand what is meant by God. I don't understand our relationship quite well. So a lot of people accept that God is a person, but when it comes down to having Him control me, then I want to hold off in that way. Let's see what else. We have a few more minutes. I wanted to get into... in the purport to 114, Prabhupada mentions Sadananda Yogendra. This is the part that Jayadvaita Swami said he couldn't understand. And this is an example of their doctrine. This is Sadananda Yogendra. This is a book called Vedanta Sara, which I have some excerpts from here. Sara means essence of Vedanta. Now this is one is actually is a commentary by Swami Nikalananda himself in there. So he says, this is the doctrine. This Sadananda Yogendra is mentioned on 101 here, the purport to 114. He describes here that ignorance, agyan, or avidya, has two aspects. individual and collective. He says, this ignorance is said to be one or many, according to the mode of observing it, either collectively or individually. And he gives the example. You can consider a tree as an aggregate and call it one thing, that is a forest, or water collectively as a reservoir. So also ignorance, which exists in jivas, is diversely manifested, but collectively can also be seen as one. So when ignorance is seen collectively as one, it is called God. Consciousness, he says, this aggregate of ignorance, on account of its appearing associated with perfection, has a preponderance of sattva. Consciousness associated with this is endowed with such qualities as omniscience, universal lordship, all-controlling power, etc., and is designated as the undifferentiated inner guide, the cause of the world, and Ishwara, and so on. So collective ignorance is called Ishwara. Swami Nikhilananda comments, the word Ishwara, popularly known as God, has a peculiar meaning in the Advaita philosophy. The Vedantist does not believe Ishwara to be the absolute existence because he is as unreal as the phenomenal universe. Brahman, associated with ignorance, is known as Ishwara. The difference between Ishwara and the ordinary man is that the former, though associated with Maya, is not bound by its fetters, whereas the latter is its slave. Ishwara is the highest manifestation of Brahman in the phenomenal universe. So anyway, it is unreal. God is unreal. That's their philosophy. So as the forest, from the standpoint of the units that compose it, may be designated as a number of trees, and a reservoir from the same point of view may be spoken of as quantities of water, so also ignorance, when denoting separate units, is spoken of as many. And there it's the jivas. So depending on how you take it, as one or as many, it's either God or the jivas. That's what Sadananda Yogendra says here in the essence of Vedanta.
There's a lot of assumptions in this statement.
Oh yeah, well, we can get into this. But anyway, that's what Prabhupada is explaining here in the same passage. I just went to the source here and looked at it, and there it is. It's really pradhan, but it means that God Himself is a product of ignorance. That's what it says. That's their position. That is to say that God, as Ishwara, is made of material nature. His name, His form, they're all composed of material nature. And he says here in text 115, this is Vishnu Ninda, blasphemy of the Lord. So then Lord Chaitanya goes on to explain how Krishna has energies, which goes on until we know this philosophy pretty much, until we come to text 121, which we'll take up tomorrow. And that where we discuss this Parinamavada and Vivartavada, these two doctrines. Now what I'd like you to do, I hope you have read this already, but what you have here, what you should have here, these are two sections from Shankaracharya. Some of you may not have this first handout, but I'd just like you to look at this, just a very brief Shankaracharya's purport to 1.4.26, Atmakrite Parinamat, is on the last page of this one here. So that's just a one paragraph. And then try to work your way through to 2.1.14. That's this one here, which is in the larger handout. That's quite long. Some of it you won't be able to understand very well, but give it a try anyway. I got two. Okay. Read the purports. Read the purport to 1:4:26.
That's only a short bit.
That's just a short little bit, right? That's all it is. Just a short little bit. And then on the one I handed out today, 2:1:14, which is a long bit. But this purport to 2:1:14 is identified by Prabhupada in the purport to text 1:21. That's where a lot of mischief occurs, by Shankaracharya. So I thought it'd be nice to try to look at it. And
where is that?
Purport to 1:21 in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Prabhupada, I found the text. Here. And we'll see how Shankaracharya contradicts Vyasadeva. Okay, any other questions? Okay, that's it for the day then. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.